If you have your Bible, turn with me, if you will, to Job chapter 23. Job chapter 23. I'm sure that all of you have heard the old joke about the man who walked into a bar late one night, and there was a blonde lady sitting at the bar. She was watching television, and so he sat down beside her, and there was a man that looked like he was going to jump from a tall building. And the man said, "Do you think he'll jump?" And the lady said, "I don't know." And so the man said, "I bet you $50 he jumps." And so they watched for a minute, and sure enough, in a moment, the man jumped. And so the woman said, "Well," and handed the $50 to the man. The man said, "I can't take your money." He said, I saw the newscast at 6, and I knew he was going to jump." And she said, "Well, I saw it too, but I didn't think he'd do it again." There are some people who don't understand the book of Job, because they think that the events perhaps are taking God by surprise. Remember back in the beginning of the book of Job, those first two chapters set the stage. Job is an upright and blameless man. He's very, very wealthy. And Satan comes and says, "Well, Job serves you because of what he has. Job serves you because you've made him prosperous and you've given him children, you've made him healthy. But if you take it away from him, Job will curse you to your face." Now, some people think, well, that was kind of a wager between God and Satan. No, it wasn't. God knew what was going to happen. He'd already seen the news at 6. God is omniscient. God knows what is going to happen. The book of Job teaches us a very valuable lesson for the 21st century. The passage that I read for the call to worship, about Paul saying that if anyone, even an angel from heaven, preaches to you another gospel, let him be cursed. And the word is literally, let him be damned. Let him be damned by God. Anathema. So it's very important that you get the gospel right. Now, there are two primary competing false gospels that are out there in the world today. One is what we would call the prosperity gospel, and it basically says that if you follow Jesus, he'll make you rich. And you'll never have any problems. Your children will never have any problems. You'll go through life, just everything will be wonderful. And if you need money, God will give you money. If you need a husband, God will give you a husband, and in some cases get rid of him or whatever. But anyway, everything will be wonderful, and God will give you anything that you want. Actually, that gospel has so permeated the continent of Africa that there has sprung up literally hundreds and thousands of churches, because there are men, unsavory characters, who are in the ministry who want to get wealthy. So they start a church so they can do it. There are parts of Africa now where wedding vows are changed. They no longer say for rich or for poor, or for better or for worse. It says for better or best, for richer and richest. Because the people just cannot countenance the idea that God doesn't want them richer and better. And the other gospel that is also very prominent in America today is what I call moral therapeutic deism. Well, what if you are already rich? As all of us are. Oh, no, wait a minute, preacher. Now, you don't know my... I'm not rich. Really? Do you have a roof over your head? Do you have heat in the winter and cool in the summer? Do you have more than one change of clothes? Do you have more than one pair of shoes? Do you have adequate food to eat? Then, by the standard of the rest of the world, we are rich. Well, what if I'm already rich? Then what can God do for me? Well, if you need purpose in life, Jesus can give you purpose in life. If you have a need for good feelings, if you're depressed, then Jesus will give you good feelings. If you feel empty inside, he will fill you. It's really the gospel of self-fulfillment. I'm already healthy and wealthy. Now I'm going to feel good too. And the book of Job tears up both of those gospels, because God allowed, in effect ordained, that Job would lose his wealth, he would lose his family, he would lose his health. Why? Because contrary to what many of us believe, God is not primarily concerned with your comfort. He was not concerned with Job's comfort. The book of Job teaches us that the most important thing in this world or in the world to come is the glory of God. It was necessary for Job to suffer so that it could be proven that there was a man who would serve God even if everything was taken away. He would serve God simply because God was worthy of being served. And the glory of God is the bottom line of everything. When we human beings seek glory, it is deeply sinful. But for God to seek his own glory is the most marvelous thing in time or eternity. Because God is glorious. Because God is God. As we come to this 23rd chapter, really, chapter 23 and 24 are Job's speech. After the heated speech of his friend. And now Job's going to have one more speech. There's going to be a real short speech by Bildad in chapter 25. And then through chapter 30 is going to be Job's last words. So 23 and 24 are the next to the last speech that Job has. Now, a very difficult thing when you are dividing a book to preach through it is where to divide it. This is one speech. So 23 and 24. So if I do one sermon, yeah, it's like an hour and a half, you know, and I didn't think y'all could stand an hour and a half of me, and I don't think I can stand an hour and a half of me. So we're going to divide it up and do 23 and 24. But they deal with two separate things. Chapter 23 deals with the vindication of the righteous, and chapter 24 deals with the judgment on evil and on the wicked. Jesus said in the Gospel of Matthew that we should pray this way to God: your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. In that prayer, Jesus is teaching us at least three things: a recognition, a hope, and a desire. First, we recognize that although God is sovereign and nothing happens outside of his will, nevertheless, his will is not done here on earth as it is done in heaven. It is done on earth completely, for there is no dualism, there is no power that can rival that of the sovereign God. So it is done completely, but it is not done perfectly. Anytime theologians talk about the will of God, they distinguish between God's sovereign, efficacious will and his will of desire. For instance, when God said, "Let there be light," the light could not have refused to shine. That was the sovereign, efficacious will of God, and the light shone forth. But God says in the Ten Commandments, "You shall not commit adultery." Do people commit adultery? Well, yeah. You see, God's will of command is different from God's will of desire. And so here on earth, though God's will is done completely, it is not done perfectly. It will not be done perfectly until the end comes, until his kingdom is established. But secondly, the fact that Jesus authorizes us to pray this prayer teaches us the sure and certain hope that one day God's will be done here on earth, even as it is in heaven. And thirdly, because Jesus tells us to pray this prayer, it teaches us that all of our desires and affections ought to be very strongly and consistently directed toward that day when his will be done perfectly here on earth, even as it is done perfectly in heaven. And there are two complementary sides to that longing. Longing for the will of God to be done perfectly involves two things. Number one, the vindication of the righteous. That's what Job talks about in chapter 23 that we're going to look at this morning. Job is a righteous man. We know that. We've been told that by the narrator. We've been told that by God. Job's three friends do not believe that. Job's three friends have bought into the prosperity gospel, and they're saying to Job, "Job, you're suffering, therefore you've sinned." Because everyone knows that if you are virtuous, then everything goes well for you. And if you are a sinner, then things go badly. Job, things have gone very, very badly for you. So, draw your own conclusion, Job. That's the essence of the speeches of Bildad, Eliphaz, and Zophar all the way through the book. Job, we know you're a vile, filthy, rotten, disgusting, scummy sinner. And the reason we know that is you lost your money, you lost your family, your children died, you lost your health. And Job longs to be vindicated. Job longs for the day when God will vindicate him. We too have that longing. Do you not? Do you not long for the day when everyone will know that following God was not a mistake? That living the Christian life was not something that you were wasting your time? That living for the glory of God is important and something that you should do? But the second longing that is reflected in that Lord's Prayer is also punishment of the wicked, of evil. We long for that as well, do we not? Do we not long for the day when evil will be banished, when there will be no sickness, no sorrow, no death, no sin, when men will do the will of God completely and perfectly, even as it is done in heaven? That is the longing of Job. In this chapter, he longs for the vindication of the righteous, specifically himself. He wants God to say, Job is my servant. He's blameless and he's upright. What we've already been told in chapters 1 and 2. And then Job longs for God to punish the wicked. He wants to see evil banished from the earth. He wants the will of God to be done completely and perfectly here on earth, even as in heaven. In the first 9 verses, we see in this chapter Job's despair. The words today also do not necessarily imply that these debates have been taking place on different days, although that could be a possibility. More likely it has the meaning of even now. Job is still suffering greatly. His complaint is bitter. The bitterness of his soul that he talked about earlier in chapter 7 is still his experience. Everything still tastes horrible to him. He's still sitting on the ash heap, covered in sores, scraping himself with a piece of broken pottery. The hand of God is still heavy against him. He cannot do what he used to do. He cannot take the actions that he wants to take. Verse 3 is somewhat remarkable. It expresses an explicit and daring wish, which is significant. The longing of Job's heart is expressed in the words, "Oh, that." Very, very powerful words. And the book of Job uses them more than any other book in the Bible. In chapter 6, Job longs that God would crush him before he denies him. "Oh, that it would please God to crush me." That was Job's prayer. "I don't want to deny you, Lord. I don't want to curse you. So crush me before I do that. Oh, that you would crush me." In chapter 14, he longs that God would hide him in Sheol. "Oh, that you would hide me until your wrath be past." In chapter 19, he uses the phrase, "Oh, that," 3 different times. His desire that his testimony would be preserved, that people would know his testimony. And in here, "Oh, that I knew where I might find him." And then finally, in his last speech, he will use it again. Job longs deeply to find God. Remember that we've been saying now for a number of weeks in these chapters that Job wants an audience with God. He, in effect, wants God to stand before him and answer his questions and tell him why all of this has taken place. And that doesn't happen. That's one of the amazing things about the book of Job. We get to the end, God really never tells Job what's been going on. Basically, we come to the end of the chapter and God just says, "Job, I'm God and you're not." And I said at the beginning of the book, that's a good thing to remember. That's always a good thing for us to remember. God is God and we're not. And sometimes you have to accept that and go on. But Job wants this audience of God. He wants to come to his seat. So in verses 4 through 7, he talks about this longed-for meeting with God. And Job says, in essence, I would tell him that I've held fast my integrity. I would tell him that I have not sinned. And I know that he would answer me. He would not crush me unfairly. He would pay attention to me. Job says, I would stand before him upright and be acquitted by my judge. Remember that the deepest longing of Job's heart is not that he would get his money back or that his children would be restored to him. The deepest longing of Job's heart is that he can stand before God righteous, that he can stand before God vindicated, that he has walked as one who loved God and trusted him. And Job's problem in finding God is that God is invisible. The words forward, backward, left hand, right hand is a Hebrew metaphor. Basically, it means I've looked east, west, north, and south, and I can't see God. God is invisible. He cannot be seen. The repeated point is wherever Job searches on the compass, even to the outer fringes of the universe, he cannot perceive or behold him. So Job cannot get this audience with God that he wants because God is invisible. Job doesn't know where to go. He doesn't know where to find him to have this audience. So he is in distress. He's in despair. So then verses 10 and 12 talks again of Job's dependence. It is important to note that even though Job cannot find him, Job still has a confidence in a final vindication. That confidence is expressed in these verses, 10, 11, 12, by terms of a clear conscience. Note the repetition of the word way. Although Job does not know where God is, he does know and follow his way, his way of life. That is, he is obedient to the commands of God that he has. And he is confident, even better, that God knows his way. God knows how Job is living. He knows that Job's life is in line with his word. Job is steadfast. My foot is held fast, verse 11. He is single-hearted. I have not turned aside. He is motivated by love, verse 12. I have treasured the words of his mouth. Job is a believer walking in faith. He cannot see what is going on. He cannot find God, but he knows that God is there. And he knows that he is walking in the way and that ultimately he will be vindicated. His conscience is clear before God. And he says that when God tries him, he will come forth as gold. The idea of trying in terms of refining and all the impurities coming out and his faith coming forth as gold. So Job longs for final vindication before God. And he is confident of final vindication before God. So in the last verses, verses 13 through 17, Job says, I know that I'll be vindicated before God. I'm confident of that, but what a huge word, but. Job says there's just one little catch, and he uses the word unchangeable. God is unchangeable. Literally in the Hebrew it says God is one. God is unique. He is the Lord God. There is none like him. There is God and there is no other. One of my pet peeves about words is I listen to newscasters sometime, and I talk to the TV. Patricia won't let me watch TV with her anymore because I talk to him. Yeah. It helps. But anyway. But when a newscaster says, now we have something that is very unique. And I go, no, it's not. It's either unique or it's not. You can't be very unique. Or they'll say, well, this is the most unique thing I've ever seen. No, it's not. You know. I don't mean to be crude or anything, but unique is one of those words, a little bit like the word pregnant. You either are or you're not, period. You know, See? So God is unique. There's none like him. He is God. There is no other. And this particular aspect of his unique deity is that he does what he chooses to do. And no human being can turn him back. Verse 13, as C.S. Lewis said so famously of Aslan in the Chronicles of Narnia, he is no tame lion. God does as it pleases him. He is not our divine bellhop that we can ring the bell and get him to do whatever we want. Job says, I am suffering, and I'm not sure my suffering is yet ended. God may have more suffering appointed for me. That's what he says in verse 14. So Job is terrified in his presence. So get the picture here. Job longs for an audience with God so that he can receive vindication, but at the same time he is terrified of God. Do we not feel some of the same thing? Even the New Covenant, we're told in the book of Hebrews that our God is a consuming fire. We know that we've been vindicated. We know that we've been declared righteous by placing our faith in Jesus Christ. And yet there is still a terror of God, or there should be. We do not breeze into his presence. We come with fear and trembling. Why? Because he is God, and we are not. He is the great God of heaven. He is not the man upstairs. And there will always be a sense of awe in his presence. Even when we have been there 10,000 years, we will still be awed in his presence. So chapter 23, in summary, expresses the longing of a true believer that he will be finally vindicated before God. And he has a measure of confidence in that vindication. He believes it is going to happen. But at the same time, there is a residue of terror, of awe, of fright to be in the presence of a sovereign and unpredictable God. For God does not always do as we think that he will do. God does not always work the way that we expect. You remember the story of Robinson Crusoe and how Crusoe is telling Friday one day about God, and he talks about, you know, God made everything, and then finally talks about putting Jesus on the cross. And Friday says, wait a minute now, Satan is the enemy of God? Yeah. Well, I don't understand. Why didn't he just kill Satan? And Crusoe sends him to the other side of the island. Why did he just kill Satan? Because his thoughts are not our thoughts and his ways are not our ways. As high as the heavens are above the earth. The book of Job teaches us to live with the mystery of God's greatness and glory, while at the same time teaching us that everything he does is right and just and good and holy, and that one day we will receive that final vindication before God. This morning we are